of this next section of this chapter about the Western disciples of Lumpur Cha is called Knower of the Worlds, and then this first part is called The Results of the Practice. Although the overwhelming majority of Westerners who entered the monastic life at Wat Bopong were male, there were also a small number of Western women who came to train as Mae Chis. Chief amongst these was an American known by her adopted name of Kumpha, who arrived with her husband Paul after fleeing their home in Laos ahead of the communist takeover in late 1975. So Kumpha, she had blonde hair, and it's in the Lao language, Kumpha means golden sky. So it was the nickname she got given in the Lao village where they lived. The couple decided to try to stay for 5 years, with the proviso that, if at any time both of them wanted to leave, then they would do so. However, in the case that one wanted to go and the other wanted to stay, then they would both carry on and endure through their difficulties. It was challenging for both of them, but they survived the 5 years. At the end of every year, Lumpur would allow Mae Chi Kumpha to go to Wat Phananachat for a few days, where she would have the chance to speak to Paul, by then known as Venerable Titapo. But mostly, their relationship was confined to the odd clandestine note secreted at an agreed spot in the forest on the Mae Chi's route to the kitchen. In many ways, it was harder for Mae Chi Kumpha. As a nun, she had much less access to Lumpur, and in the Mae Chi section, her inspiration could easily waver. But Venerable Titapo did not find monastic life easy either. And sometimes he would probably have preferred the distance from Lumpur that his wife resented. If you catch that one, he would have preferred to be further away from Lumpur Cha. Rather like Waropanyo, then Paul was a good sufferer, and Lumpur was generously merciless in his readiness to sort of approach Paul's difficulties. So I knew him very well. He was a junior monk when I showed up at Wat Phananachat in 1978. So we spent a lot of time together, often down at the dyeing shed, having illicit cups of tea and conversations together. By the late 1970s, Lumpur had become a more grandfatherly figure, but the old fire and ability to give corrosive admonishments would occasionally surface. He could also accomplish the effect of a scolding without speaking a word, as he demonstrated one day when he caught Venerable Titapo breaking a key monastic regulation. Private supplies of tea, coffee, sugar, and so on were forbidden at Wat Bopong. Everybody was expected to be content with whatever communal drinks were provided. However, a number of the Western monks, Venerable Titapo included, persuaded themselves that they were a special case in this respect, and if they were discreet enough about it, boiling a pot of water in the forest and having a cup of tea together was a minor, harmless indulgence. Every now and again, they would meet at Venerable Titapo's kuti, where an ancient black kettle was secreted. You can see where this one's going. So one day, Venerable Titapo received a parcel of fine teas from his sister in England. In the late afternoon, he made a small fire in the forest behind his kuti, at a spot where the smoke would not be visible from the path, to enjoy a first cup of the new batch. But when an involuntary shiver passed through his body, he quickly turned round to see a motionless and stone-faced Lumpur watching him. It was the proverbial nightmare come true. Lumpur walked over to the illicit supplies, lifted up his walking stick, and knocked over a few jars of tea with a crash, spat on the ground, and walked off in silence. Lumpur spent most of the second half of 1979 overseeing the renovation of the monastery in Bangkor, that's his home village, where he had spent his first years in the robes. Towards the end of the year, Venerable Titapo was assigned as his attendant. One day, a group of Thai visitors began to praise the Western monks for their renunciation and dedication. Lumpur agreed, yes, his Western disciples were accomplished. Many of them could chant the Patimokkha. They're all very intelligent. He paused dramatically, except for this one. He pointed at Titapo. He's really stupid. Afterwards, Lumpur asked Titapo slyly if he got angry when he treated him like that. Titapo said, how can you get angry with a mountain? Lumpur was delighted. Laughing, he turned to one of the novices by his side. Write that down, write that down. Eventually, the 5 years were up, and in the last few months, Kamphar's growing sense of isolation in the Meiji section had been exploited by a fundamentalist Christian missionary. This had culminated, somewhat bizarrely, in her conversion. Maybe she's right, said a deadpan Lumpo, startling Ajahn Sumedho, who brought the news. There's a whole story involved with that. So this had culminated, somewhat bizarrely, in her conversion to Christianity. Maybe she's right, said a deadpan Lumpo, startling Ajahn Sumedho, who brought the news. After their departure, Exti Tapo adopted his wife's faith. The couple sent letters to Western monks lamenting what they called the aridity of Buddhist spirituality and exulting in what they believed to be a shared sense of Christ's presence. One of the main complaints was that after 5 years in the Wat, they could see no tangible results from their practice. No matter how much they had tried, life had always seemed to remain pretty much the same. These comments were passed on to Lumpo. Then, one day, a photo of the couple with their first child arrived in the post. It was shown to Lumpo. He looked at it for a moment and then said, "At last, they've seen the results of their practice." So, again, not a very cuddly or consoling kind of a comment, but you know, very very monastic in its tone. So when I showed up in early 1978, then Paul was Tanti Tapo was one of the junior monks there. So we became very good friends, and I said, as I said, I had a number of illicit tea times down at the Dying Shed, which is also known as the Psychological Release Center, where we'd wash our robes, and it was a little more tolerable to have your own supply down there, and there was often just a tin of tea kept on a shelf down there in the Dying Shed, so it wasn't quite so illegal. But anyway, he was a very, very good friend, and so I wasn't around when they got converted to Christianity. That was in 1981. Lumpo Sumedho made his first trip back. Lumpo Cha had been to visit England in 77 when he brought Ajahn Sumedho, and then in 79. But Lumpo Sumedho hadn't been back since he left in 1977. So in 81, he went back and took a large group, a couple of dozen lay Buddhists, and also Ajahn Chandasiri went along. She was an eight precept nun at that time. And so Lumpo Sumedho said, "Oh, it'd be really good. You have the opportunity to meet Sister Kamphar. She's been a nun for 5 years. She's really committed. She's very determined. She's a very impressive nun." So he'd kind of been building her up to Ajahn Chandasiri about how inspiring and great this was. And so then when he got there, it was one of many learning experiences that Lumpo Sumedho had on that trip, one of which was never take a group of lay people to Asia again. So he then heard this rumor that Meiji Kamphar and Tanti Tapo had been converted to Christianity, and that he couldn't really believe it at first, and went over to see them, and then they had this long session together, and they were all full of the light and their newly found faith. And so after that session of 2 or 3 hours, then Lumpo Sumedho went to see Lumpo Cha, and so he was then telling Lumpo that they had become Christians. And so and he was in this sort of, "I can't believe it. This is so stupid. They've been practicing, they've been right next to you, they've heard the teaching, they've been meditating for so long. How can they be so stupid? This is ridiculous." And that's when Lumpo Cha said, "Maybe they're right." Yeah. And then there was this, as many of you have probably heard Lumpo Sumedho describe, he thought, "He's joking. He's not joking. He must be joking. He doesn't look like he's joking." And again, Lumpo Cha was an amazing comedian, so he could kind of let a theme like that run for quite a while before you realize what, you know, whether he really was joking or not. Another memory I had of Tanti Tapo was he had, even though this is being recorded, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, but he had been a drug smuggler, and Meiji Kamphar had been one of his runners, his mules, and then he and his mule had fallen for each other and then become a couple. They were living in a village in Laos. So they spoke very, very good Lao and could understand and speak the local dialect in northeast Thailand. And before they had entered the Sangha, Thitarpa had put the proceeds, the profits from their trade, into a bank in the Cayman Islands. And life in the forest in northeast Thailand is extremely boring. Nothing very much happens. And the post would only be coming to the monastery a couple of days a week. And yeah, and it wouldn't be uncommon that there was like one letter would arrive for the whole Sangha during a week or every couple of weeks. So at a certain point, when I was a novice living there and Tanti Thapa was there, then these aerograms, these letters from the Cayman Islands with very colourful stamps started arriving. Oh, that's interesting, Cayman Islands. Oh, those are nice stamps. And so then it's a letter for Tanti Thapa. His name was Paul Bainham, so it was kind of addressed to Mr. P. Bainham. And so then he take the letter and scoot off and then come, and then you see him later in the day with a sort of scowl on his face. And I didn't really think about it very much. And then two or three days later, another letter from the Cayman Islands comes, and then it gets passed on to him. And I'm still thinking, oh, nice stamps. These are colourful. Like often poor countries have very colourful stamps, so that it's a kind of advertising for their country. And so about the third time, a letter from the Cayman Islands arrived, and he looked even more kind of depressed and thunderous and sort of scowling. And I said, so, and I thought, oh, it must be some relative, maybe his dad was actually, an admiral in the Royal Navy. He was like a naval officer, Admiral Bainham. And I thought, oh, maybe his dad's got posted in the Caribbean, is sending him sending him messages. And then after about the third round, he was looking really kind of depressed. And he said, I said, what's up? And he said, my bank's crashed. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Kumfar and I had a certain amount of savings. And I put them all in this bank in the Cayman Islands because there's very low tax and very high interest. The bank has crashed. And the last letter told me that all my money's gone. So I, being extremely naive and idealistic as a novice monk, well, that's all right, you're a monk anyway. Yeah, so you don't really need it anyhow, do you? And he gave me this look like... Some of us might be lifers, but some of us are not. And so I literally thought, well, that's all right, you're a monk, you don't need money, well, it's all just smoke in the wind, so, nothing's really lost, is it? So then we sort of looked at each other. So that was one of the Thitarpa stories. But to their credit, he and Kumfar have been living in Laos for all these years, and they were part of a Christian missionary community, and they've been sort of running schools and carrying out continuous sort of social services and support for poor families in rural Laos for the last 30, 40 years. So they have, not been in the Buddhist fold, as it were, but they've been living good lives and really working hard to help people in the world, so we shouldn't make too much fun of them. And once in a while, we do hear word from them. Actually, one of the monks from Abhayagiri was staying at Wat Phananachat, and Paul showed up from Laos. He was just paying a visit and just sort of thought he'd just take a look at Wat Phananachat and see how the place was developing over the years, and met with this monk from Abhayagiri, Tanjodi Palo. So Jodi Palo said, oh, right, tell me all the stories. So he wanted to hear the tales of the old days about Ajahn Pasno and myself. So they had a really good connection. It was very, very, very delightful. And so that it was the friendship carries on in a small way. The last time I saw him was probably about 1981 or so. Down at Chidhurst, there was a project down at the Nuns' Cottage to put in a new bathroom, and so I was helping. And Tan Subhuto was a very good builder, and so he was in the midst of building this sort of bathroom and shower, and I was doing the tiling down at the nun's cottage, at Aloka Cottage, and I was in the middle of doing my tiling job, and suddenly this man appeared in the doorway with a black, you know, thick black moustache and a sort of and a twinkle in his eye. And I said, "Can I help you?" He looked at me and said, "You don't recognize me, do you?" I said, and I was going, and I said, "Titapo." And he said, "Very good." So I'd never seen him with a moustache. But and he was in England visiting family, and that was the last time I had seen him. So we had a bit of time to chat, catch up. But that was, you know, nearly 40 years ago. So I haven't personally been in touch, but so those little connections carry on. The next section is called Nature and Nurture. Whereas Lungpo had obviously thought the Venerable Titapo would benefit from blunt or humbling words, he saw others were more in need of attention and nurture. Venerable Varapanyo was a member of this group. As a young monk, Venerable Varapanyo struggled with a craving for sugar, which culminated in him gorging on a packet of candies sent in a care package from home. The lapse propelled him into a frenzy of guilt and self-loathing. He went to confess to Lungpo. This is Varapanyo speaking. "I blurted out, 'I'm impure, my mind is soiled, I'm no good.' He looked very concerned. 'What is it?' he asked. I told him the story. Naturally, he was amused, and within a few minutes I realized that he had me laughing. I was very light-hearted. The world was no longer about to end. In fact, I'd forgotten about my burden. This was one of his most magical gifts. You could feel so burdened and depressed and hopeless, and after being around him for a few minutes, it all vanished, and you found yourself laughing. Sometimes you only needed to go and sit down at his kuti, be around him as he spoke to others. Even when he was away, I would get a contact high, quote-unquote, of peacefulness as soon as I got near his kuti to clean up or sweep leaves." But it was the opportunity to serve as Lumpur's attendant that was to have the most profound effect. So again, this is Varapanyo speaking for the next section. There was usually a lot of competition for the honour of waiting on him, but I was allowed to go to his kuti for the early morning chores before dawn. It meant getting up earlier in the chilly mornings, but I was inspired. The more I hung around him, the safer I felt. He would give me little discourses from time to time, keep checking to see how I was doing, ask me about my past, etc. I began to feel, here is somebody unshakable, like a mountain. To believe in God is to know that somebody somewhere is not stupid. It really seemed to me that I had found that somebody. He was to me what you always expected your father, family doctor, priest, teacher, Santa Claus, and Superman to be, all rolled into one. He would keep on pulling rabbits out of the hat, teachings, things to do, medicines, whatever, so that the situation began to feel open-ended, like there were unlimited possibilities awaiting me, much different from the dreary path I had imagined for so long. So, in the morning I'd boil water and bring hot and cold water for him to wash his face. When he came downstairs, I would give him the water and kneel there with a towel while one of the novices took his false teeth to clean them. Usually, he'd walk around with the towel afterwards and let me follow until he finally gave it up for me to hang up. His robes would be made ready to put on for alms round, but first he would check things out at his kuti, throw some rice to the wild chickens, sit down and talk, drink tea. Occasionally, a couple of nuns would come at this time to discuss something. It was always interesting to watch the local monks and nuns when they came to see him. They spoke to him with the utmost deference, almost as if they were terrified of him. With us Westerners, he was usually the kindly old man, though over the years I was to see him play many different roles. He could make you love him or hate him, feel respect, fear, doubt, or disgust for him, and he could juggle your mind states around quite rapidly. For me, at that time, he was instilling faith. Those early morning scenes were especially effective. The wat was almost empty, most of the monks having left earlier for the other alms round routes, and we were limited to about 15 minutes before we had to go, so the situation felt intensified. despite the fact that it was so funny to see the great man sitting there with his teeth out, all of a sudden looking like a little old Ukrainian grandmother. It's true, Lumpur would frequently take his teeth out and hand them to the Upatak to clean. And it was often one of the things he would do if someone who was talking to him was like being particularly intellectual or very sort of pompous or some sort of high-ranking official or some sort of duke or duchess. You know, so he would come and listen very carefully and thoughtfully and then take his teeth out and hand them to the Upatak. And so his lips would fold in over his gums. And without kind of missing a beat, would see whether the university professor or the local governor of the province would wobble, or if the Duchess would be offended that he just took his teeth out and to see whether or have an impact or not. In the afternoons, after sweeping his kuti, emptying his spittoon and so on, I would sit down for a while to listen as he spoke to whoever was there, sometimes to talk or maybe be given a cup of tea, but mostly just to be there. After the guests were gone, he took his bath, with a few of us helping him, holding his towel, taking his robe, offering the dry bathing cloth, washing his back and feet, cleaning his sandals. As Venerable Varapanyo became more settled and confident, Lumpur started to use him as a figure in his teaching stories. Varapanyo usually filled the role of the fool, sometimes the fool who never got it right, sometimes the fool who sees the light. Again, this is Varapanyo's account. It was getting cold, and a monk who was leaving suggested that his kuti might be a bit more comfortable since it was smaller and less draughty. So I moved. But it was near the wall of the wat, and the farmers would pass by with their buffalo in the daytime. This disturbed me because I was still convinced that meditation and noise don't mix. So, after a few days, I moved back. Someone noticed, of course. The CIA has nothing on the monastic grapevine. It's true. The CIA has nothing on the monastic grapevine and duly reported it to Lumpur. He questioned me about it, and over the years, I was to hear the story many times, expanded and embellished. He would often use incidents like this, somewhat tailored to fit his purpose, to teach. He would tell people about learning the mind's tricks, how it becomes bored and dissatisfied, always wanting something else. Take Varapanyo, for example. He came to Wat Wapong and was sitting in his kuti, but he wasn't happy. He moved all his things, went to live in the other kuti, but he wasn't happy there either. So he thought the first kuti was better, and he moved back there. He always told stories in a very gentle and funny way. Everyone would have a good laugh, and he'd make his point. It's the mind that does it all. Know your mind. So also, when it reminds me when he was in America and was staying at the cabin outside of Seattle in Washington State that belonged to Ajahn Prabhakaro's parents, they were staying up at this cabin just below Stevens Pass in the mountains, and there was the family dog was there, and they were sitting in the living room, and the dog was outside, scratched on the door to be let in. And then Prabhakaro would get up, let the dog in, and then the dog would sort of run around the living room a couple of times and scratching the door to be let out. So he'd get up, let him out, and then be outside for a few minutes and scratch on the door to be let in again. And said, "Prabhakaro, Prabhakaro, it's just like you." Yeah. When you're on your own, you want to be with the monks. When you're with the monks, you want to be on your own. Yeah. So just like you, isn't it? Yeah. So you'd frequently use this kind of circumstantial situations to convey these teachings. March and April were the cruelest months for hot weather. The Western monks would drag themselves around, occasionally lapsing into daydreams of a cooling thunderstorm. Again, this is Varapanyo speaking. The heat was a torment with the fatigue and discomfort that it brought me. One afternoon, somebody brought iced drinks from town. I drank several glasses and felt so relieved that I soon started thinking I could have my family donate an ice machine to Wat Wapong. It could be run on a generator for a few hours each day and we'd always have ice. It seemed like a perfectly valid thought to me. Finally, I began to realize that the Buddha lived in the forest and did his ascetic practices without our modern conveniences such as ice, so I could probably endure and survive without it. I later told Lumpur of this episode I'd gone through in my mind. It became one of his teaching stories about how to contemplate situations to eliminate unnecessary suffering. Warapanya was living in the forest and the hot season came. He was so hot, he was really unhappy. All he could think about was ice. But then he contemplated, when the Buddha lived in the forest, did he have ice? No, he didn't. This was wisdom arising. So then he became happy. His problem was resolved. It's also the case in the early days before the Westerners showed up in Wat Bopong, there was an occasion when some lay people brought some soft drinks and a bucket of ice from the local town, from Warin. And Lumpur Cha received the visitors and then said, I'll take the ice away, it'll ruin the monks. So that was even in the more austere days. This next section is called Nobody Knows. Lumpur could be so acute and penetrating about the general ways of the world that the Western monks could be surprised at how little interest he had in the details of that world and how little knowledge. Nevertheless, he occasionally showed curiosity about the West and its culture and customs. One day he asked Ajahn Sumedho what hippies were, and after listening to the description, he said that it sounded like they would make good monks. Venerable Warapanya recalled, occasionally, Lumpur would ask about Western life and customs, about my past experiences, about science. Astronomy was usually interesting to the Thais. He was disinterested in that he obviously wasn't hankering after anything, yet he was very, very interested because he all of a sudden had on his hands several of these people from a part of the world he knew hardly anything about, and he cared about us. One thing he never showed any interest in was politics, either domestic or international. One day, sometime after Nixon was re-elected, he said, Nixon ran away with it. A visitor must have told him, and he just passed on to me that one line. And then, one time when a few of us went to see him, he said, CIA, nobody knows who they are. Who is the CIA? Nobody knows. And that was the extent of the political discussion I can remember having with him. But also in that time, the CIA was extremely active in northeast Thailand, and so that the illicit bombing raids into Laos and Cambodia were flown out of Ubon Air Force Base, and so that I think it was Air America was the name of the quote unquote airline that was actually clandestine bombing raids on countries that America was not supposed to be fighting or had anything to do with. So. They had a big presence through that area. And it's also when somebody asked Lumpur Cha about why he never spoke about politics in any way, shape or form, he said, I only talk about things that have an end. Politics has no end, therefore I don't talk about it. Which is a very, very succinct way of describing it, and I think very, very, very helpful in that respect. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yeah.
I wonder, for this couple in the tried for 5 years and in a good environment, it was because they didn't go, they still had the thoughts about a future that they might have when 5 years would be over.
I think so, and also the fact that they did have a good marriage, and that they had had a sense for the need for spiritual to develop the spiritual dimension, and so they'd gone into the monastery as he describes it. It was an experiment to see how it would be. So having that thought in the back of the mind, well, this is just temporary, or I'm only doing this for a while, that has a powerful effect. And actually, one of the things that Titapo said to me. I think just when I was a novice with him at Wat Nanachat, he said, "You're a lifer," it means you're going to do this for life, just because of the way I would speak, and it was always so that sense of his part, his commitment to Kumpha and her commitment to him, it was always kind of there in the background, and so that has its effect. So it's sometimes people who are married and particularly if they're older, but sometimes when they're younger, then they'll take leave from their partner and so go into the monastery, and they start off just for a period of time, where it's like for a 3-month rains retreat or for a year, and so that then it's with the family's agreement, and they people are quite supportive of that, and the society understands that. If you work if you're in the military, or you're a government officer, like a civil servant, every 10 years you get 3 months paid leave to go and be in a monastery. So if you were like an administrative officer for Ubon province, and you've been doing that for 15 years, they say, oh, you know, you can take 3 months off and go and be a Mechi, and your partner would still receive your salary while you're in the monastery. So you get paid leave for 3 months every 10 years if you're in government service. So that's kind of the cultural form of stepping out of the marriage or stepping out of the family and going into the monastery for a period of time. So sometimes it happens that people do that with an open-ended way, that say, like, I'm really tired of the marriage, you know, this doesn't really feel something that's satisfying, and I really feel a pull towards monastic life. And so they'll go into the monastery, and they think, well, I'll give it a try. And that they step out of the marriage and sort of take leave of the children or grandchildren or whatever, and then go into the monastery, and then they might be in for 6 months or a year and then decide, okay, this is really good. I'm really getting a lot from this. I'll carry on. And again, culturally, the family would there's a way that sort of sits within the family. It's like, okay, well, it's sad that he or she's not around, but that this is important for them. And then they would come and visit the person in the monastery, the mother or the father or grandmother. And they would relate to them in a different way. They would use a different language to speak with them, and they use different terms of address. They wouldn't just relate them to them as dad or mum or granny. You know, they would say, you know, Long Mae or Long Po, and they would relate to them in a different way. So the society supports that, because also in Asia, and I mean, I realize that Asian people here, but the sort of romantic, you know, a couple falling in love with each other and living happily ever after, that's not seen as the ultimate goal of human life. Where in the West, it tends to be meeting your true love and getting married and living happily ever after is a sort of fairy tale. And there isn't much beyond that. You know, nobody talks about sainthood. You know, you don't find any couples that say, you know, that, well, yes, we're married together and we've got very nice children, grandchildren, but actually what I'm really aiming for is sainthood before I die. Well, nobody says that. It's just not a cultural model. I want to try and introduce it as a cultural model. One of my plans is to try and, so that people can look beyond getting their kids into college and having a good retirement plan and enough money to pay for a care home. But I think we can do better than that. But in the West, it's not an exaggeration that the idea of aiming for sainthood or liberation as a goal for a human life is kind of unheard of. Culturally, it just doesn't exist. It's like a happy marriage and healthy children and grandchildren that have good table manners and speak with a nice accent and have good jobs. That's most of what people can look forward to. And so in Asia, it's the marriage and partnership is seen as, you know, that's part of life, but it's not the goal of life. It can't really make you happy. And that liberation, you know, enlightenment, whether it's in the Buddhist sense of enlightenment, or say within the Hindu tradition, moksha, you know, liberation, and that it's very much the spiritual development is, well, that's really what life is about. That's the real purpose of life. That's the real potential that we have, and that marriage and family is a step along the way. So both within the Hindu structure of things and the Buddhist structure of things, it's very, very clear, very, very much articulated, and so that, like within Christianity, sainthood is, or that sort of spiritual excellence is like a few people. You have to be dead before you can be a saint. When I was a little child, and I found that out from my mum, you know, that you had to be dead before you could be a saint. I thought, that's ridiculous. You can't be a saint until you're dead. She said, "No, you have to be. You can't become. You can't be made a saint until you're dead already." That's stupid. I was only about six or seven, but I thought it was really ridiculous. So, well, if you're already a saint, I mean, if you must be, if you're recognised as a saint, you must be. People must know that when you're alive, but you can't get called a saint until you're dead. She said, "No, you can't. You have to be dead before you're a saint." And Church of England doesn't make any saints. Only the Catholics have saints. What? So I was really annoyed. I was, you know. But it was kind of a totally stupid setup. You know, you've got to be a dead Catholic before you can be a saint. I realise this is being recorded, but... I would say that to a Catholic priest. I've met a few cardinals even, and I would be happy to say that to them. Yeah. So stepping out of the marriage and entering into spiritual life then is something that is seen as something that is praiseworthy and something that people will be encouraged or admired to be doing. In the most part. And so I think you have to ask Kamfa and Titapo, but I think for them there was always that, well, we'll do this for 5 years and we'll see. So it was really much a time frame in their minds, and then that had its effect. And then that conversion to Christianity was just a part of that, it came in as unexpected element of the picture. But it was part of that. They knew that the years were ticking by. I think there was a certain amount of looking forward to it. And certainly, I knew Titapo much better than Sister Kamfa. But there was a certain amount of counting the weeks and months and being in the process. Well, this is like a long retreat, and after that we'll go on to something else. The next section is called Parental Caution. At one point in the ordination ceremony, the applicant is asked in the midst of the Sangha, Anunyatosi mata pituhi, do you have your parents' permission? And the candidate will reply, Ama bante, yes, Venerable Sir. It's fortunate that a candidate's failure to admit to parental opposition at this juncture does not invalidate the ceremony, for many Western monks were unable to gain the blessing of their parents until long after their admission into the Sangha. Some monks endured years of rejection by their families. Others received regular letters begging them to come home. Impossible to discard unopened, but heart-wringing to read beyond the first few lines. For their part, some parents were agonized by thoughts of their son as a brainwashed member of a strange cult in the heart of a steamy jungle. Others felt hurt at the rejection of their own values and religious traditions and grieved at the loss of the dreams they cherished for their son or their daughter. Even those parents who respected and supported their son's choice, the numbers of whom probably exceed those that did not, had to cope with the sorrow of knowing it might be years before they saw him again. Some monks succumbed to the pressure of emotional blackmail. One was tricked into returning to England by a telegram falsely informing him that his mother had had a heart attack. For others, when their practice faltered, knowing that their parents disapproved of what they were doing made it harder for them to justify to themselves the pain they were causing. Lack of parental support was often a factor, sometimes a decisive one, when monks, afflicted by doubts, discouragement, or sensual desires, were considering a return to the lay life. However, in almost every case of those monks who stayed on, their parents eventually came round. At last, a conciliatory letter would arrive, announcing a visit, or offering a plane ticket for a visit home, expressing acceptance of their son's way of life. Lumpur went out of his way to welcome the parents of his Western disciples, the Wat Bapong. The warmth and kindness he showed to them was dialed up to such a dazzling intensity that few could resist. Most parents would be thoroughly charmed and their worries put to rest. Even the most skeptical of parents would show signs of thawing. And this is a quote, "I must say, he certainly got something about him," they'd say after meeting him, or admit, "Well, he does seem like a very nice man." Also, they saw positive changes in their sons, which they could not help but feel proud of. They were impressed by the great reverence with which the monks were treated by the people on every level of Thai society. Even if in their heart of hearts they hoped that their son might someday give up the robe, at least for the time being, their minds were at peace. It was very much the case of my family. That the first 15 years was, they told me later on, they were sort of waiting for me to see sense. So, but I was only 21 when I became a novice, so it was a difficult dynamic. And the youngest child, only son, so it was a bit of a loaded item in my family. But eventually, after both my sisters were reaching 40, neither had got married, no children in sight, I was a Buddhist monk. So, yeah. I think they sort of collectively threw their hands up and thought, whatever. And something shifted about that time when I was in my mid-30s. In the early 1980s, there began an ultimately unsuccessful attempt to start a Mechi community at Wat Phananashat. A young woman from Hong Kong, Sister Sudhamma, became one of its first members. Her parents were extremely upset, and the mother wrote at regular intervals imploring her daughter to come home. The nun wrote back, politely and refusing, and asking for time and understanding. On receiving it, the mother immediately replied with a threat to kill herself. The nun became very anxious, not really believing the threat, not wanting to return to Hong Kong, and yet unsure of the right thing to do. Lumpur advised her not to disrobe, but to invite her mother to come and visit. He said, "She feels this antipathy because, not having seen for herself what you're doing, she's imagining a lot of bad things." He made a comparison. This is Lumpur speaking. "To tell you the truth, I was like that once, but with cheese. Ugh! I hated the smell of it. It was awful. When I went to the West, everyone reeked of the stuff. But I got closer and closer to it, and then one day they gave me some. I thought, I might as well give it a try. Mmm, it was pretty good. Now I think it's delicious. These days I eat more than the Westerners do. I used to think it smelled like chicken shit, and now I like it. So, stay. It won't be long and your mother will come." So it's a very unusual comparison to make, but Lumpur was extremely creative in his analogies and similes and sort of things that would come to mind. So that was a particularly unique one. Which she did. The mother came to visit, and after the initial suspicion and paranoia had worn off, she began to understand, if not condone, her daughter's decision, and returned to Hong Kong with her mind much calmed. Another occasion on which Lumpur's skills in diplomacy were displayed came with the arrival of Randy, later Ajahn Kittisaro, a champion wrestler and a Rhodes Scholar, that's a particular scholarship to Oxford University. A Rhodes Scholar from Tennessee. During his summer break from Oxford, Randy had travelled to Thailand to research Thai Buddhism. There he met Lumpur and became inspired by him to become a monk. Randy's parents were shocked and deeply worried. They flew out to Thailand to save him from brainwashing and the ruin of his future. On meeting Lumpur, however, their concerns dissolved. They were impressed at the changes they saw in their son, a newfound self-discipline, calmness and resolve. Lumpur put forward Randy's novice ordination in order that his parents could be present to see their son enter the Sangha before they returned home. On the morning of the ceremony, they went into town and bought food to offer to the Sangha of Wat Phananashat as a celebratory offering on an auspicious day. So he was actually in the middle of his postgraduate degree at Oxford University. So he got a Rhodes Scholarship. He'd been a champion wrestler in the USA, he did his initial degree in Tennessee, then he was at Columbia University in New York, and then got the scholarship to go to Oxford. So he was in the middle of his degree at Oxford when he went off to Thailand, and so he dropped out of a degree at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar in order to become a monk. So the family were very much like, you know, our son, the golden boy, and he's an athlete. he's brilliant, and he's a really good lad, and suddenly, whoomp, lost into the jungles of Thailand. They dropped out of Oxford University and gone off to live in the jungle. And having had no background or interest in Buddhism before having come to England, so they were really kind of alarmed and worried. Again, he and I, he was a junior monk like with Tutapa when I first showed up there. So he and I were also very, very good friends. And he was a very accomplished athlete when he first showed up, as a kind of hippie student type in the, about 1976. Then he when he met Ajahn Sumedho at Wat Phananchat, kind of introduced himself and said, "Hi, I'm Randy," and and then was talking about where he come from and his background. And mentioned that he was an athlete, and he was not only was he a wrestler doing Greek wrestling. He was the Eastern States champion of the U.S. twice, 2 years in that era. But he was also quite a gymnast. And they said, so Ajahn Sumedho said, "So what kind of thing can you do as a gymnast?" He said, "Well, I can do backflips." And he went across the whole length of the sala at Wat Phananchat doing backflips, head over heels backflips, so the whole length of the sala. He's wearing dungarees. Unusual character. So he made his mark literally from the day he arrived. And also didn't have a problem with shyness. So the next section is called A Snake in the House. Over the years, many Western laypeople came to stay at Wat Bapong. A large number arrived without any intention of becoming monks or nuns, but simply with the wish to meet and receive teachings from Lungpo, and to participate for some time in the life of the monastic community. Usually, Lungpo would delegate basic teaching duties to a senior Western monk, but every now and again he would give a Dhamma talk to the lay guests or answer their questions. It's sometimes alleged that monks are dismissive of lay practice, and that great masters reserve the most profound teachings for those who have made a commitment to monastic life. This was not the case with Lungpo. Western lay guests, with a sincere interest in practice, energized him. Indeed, monks would become excited if they knew that Lungpo was going to give a Dhamma talk to the foreign lay guests, because of the profundity of the Dhamma that they might expect to hear. One talk, subsequently published as Living with the Cobra, gives a good idea of the flavor of these teachings. In it, Lungpo compared mental states, both positive and negative, to poisonous snakes. Identifying with a mental state, he said, was like letting yourself be bitten by a cobra. The separation from the truth of things that results from that identification is like death from the cobra's poison. And this is Lungpo speaking. All mental states are like cobras. If nothing obstructs their path, they just glide along their way. Even though they possess venom, it's inside them. They are of no danger to us as long as we don't go near them. They just do what cobras naturally do. Intelligent people let go of attachment to everything, both good and bad. They let go of both what they like and what they dislike. It's as if we were to release a cobra from captivity. It would slither away, taking its poison with it. And that's the way we release mental states. We release the good and bad with an awareness of their nature. We don't touch them, don't take hold of them, because we don't want anything. We don't want good or bad, heavy or light, pleasure or pain. A conclusion is reached, and a lucid calm is firmly established. He taught that the path of practice was founded on the development of mindfulness and alertness. When these two factors were mature, the wisdom faculty would arise naturally, and the meditators would then be wakeful day and night. Practitioners would be close to the Buddha at all times. The term arising of wisdom, quote unquote, means that through clearly seeing how all phenomena arise and fall according to causes and conditions, meditators abandon attachment to them as self or adjuncts of self. Again, Lungpo is speaking. When things arise, we know. When they cease, we know. When there's happiness, we know. And when there's unhappiness, we know. Once we know, we don't take possession of that happiness or unhappiness. When there is no sense of possession of those feelings, then all that remains is the simple process of arising and ceasing, Let it follow its natural course, because there's nothing there worth attaching to. At this time, Lungpo had been reading Zen Buddhist texts and gave his own view on the relationship between Nibbana and Samsara discussed in them. So Ajahn Buddhadasa had translated a couple of key Buddhist Zen Buddhist teachings, the Sutra of Huineng, the Platform Sutra, and also the teachings of Huang Po. Ajahn Buddhadasa put those into Thai, so Lumpu Cha could read them in Thai language. So again, this is Lumpu Cha speaking. The Buddha said that Nibbana is cessation. Where does that cessation take place? Well, it's like a fire. It's extinguished wherever it springs up, wherever it's burning. You cool something at the place where it's hot. It's the same with Nibbana and Samsara. They lie in the same place. The Buddha taught us to put out the fire of Samsara, that is inner turmoil. Bringing inner turmoil to cessation is called putting out the fire. External fires are hot, and when they've been put out, there is coolness. The inner heat of greed, hatred, and delusion are also fires. Think about it. When sexual desire arises in the mind, it's hot, isn't it? If anger arises, it's hot. If delusion arises, it's hot. It's this heat which the Buddha called the fires. When fires spring up, there's heat. When they're extinguished, there is coolness. Nibbana is the state that cools the heat. The Buddha called it peace, the cessation of the wheel of birth and death. Then at the end of this discourse, Lungpo descended from the exalted level in which he'd been dwelling to address some warm personal words to the elderly English woman who was the recipient of the talk. And her name was Marjorie Still. I was actually present when Lungpo gave this talk, I believe. She was about to go back to England. She was at Wat Nanachat, and she was about to go back to England. And so this was the final advice that Lungpo gave her before she set off. When you first arrived, you cried. When I saw your tears, I felt happy. Why was that? Because I knew you were going to be studying the true Dhamma. If no tears flow, then you won't see the Dhamma. Because the fluid in tears is bad stuff. You have to let it all out before you can feel at ease. So, please take this Dhamma away with you and put it into practice. Practice in order to transcend suffering. Die before death and peaceful and be peaceful and at ease. So that's also a very common expression, dai gon dai, so die before you die. So to let go of self before the life comes to an end. But occasionally Lungpo could treat foreign guests with great abruptness. One day a Western woman arrived at Lungpo's kuti while he was talking to some of the monks. He asked one of the Western monks present to ask her what she wanted. The monk translated, "She's asking permission to stay. She would like to receive teachings from Lungpo." Lungpo scowled. "Tell her that there's no teaching here. All I do is torment people." After shocking everyone in earshot, Lungpo relented and the woman was led away to the Mechi section. Lungpo gave no reason for his words, and each person was left to speculate on why Lungpo thought this particular woman would benefit from such a welcome. For the Western monks, living with loose ends such as these, when they weren't quite sure what had just happened, was a normal part of the life at Wat Bapong. On another occasion, a European academic arrived with a questionnaire. It's like a list of questions they'd been asking various different spiritual teachers all around Asia. He asked Lungpo through a translator, "Why do you practice? How do you practice? What are the results of your practice?" Lungpo replied, "Why do you eat? How do you eat? What are the results of your eating?" Lungpo smiled. The scholar frowned and asked for an explanation. So he was quite offended and thought, "I've asked you a serious question. You know, are you joking with me, or are you kind of making fun of me?" And actually, he's given the abbreviated version here because actually Lungpo said, wait a minute. And he got one of the notes, give me a pen and paper. I need to write this down. I've got to get this. And he did a whole kind of theatrical performance about getting the paper. Okay, what was the first one? Okay. And second, what was the second one? So he did a whole sort of a whole thing around it. So, and the guy was again not quite sure. Is he making fun of me? What's this about? What's he doing here? Is he taking me seriously? Is this genuine? What's he doing? Lumpur then explained, "Think about it. Why do you eat? Because you're hungry, and if you don't eat, you'll suffer. Why do we practice? Because we're hungry. Food relieves the pain of physical hunger, and Dhamma relieves the mental and spiritual hunger. If the mind is suffering, then you must use Dhamma to alleviate it. How do we practice? Just as we put food into our stomach, so must we put Dhamma into our heart. What are the results of our practice? Well, it's just like eating. The results of eating are that your stomach is full of food. The results of practicing is that your heart is full of Dhamma." So that gives a good sort of synopsis. And again, that sense of what just happened there. And as I was mentioning yesterday, you could never second guess Lumpur. So someone might come along, they might seem very kind of humble and sincere and serious, and Lumpur will say, "What do you want?" like that. And you think, why is he being so harsh? And then someone else might come along, and you think, someone who seems to be really proud or inflated, or that they kind of sit right at the front and look at me, I'm special, I've got important, serious Dhamma questions, and you think, Lumpur's really going to let this guy have it. And then he'd be extremely kind of sweet and kind and thoughtful. You think, and you thought that he was going to, this inflated person was going to have their bubble burst. So you can never really tell. And as soon as you thought, it was going to go one way, it would go a different direction. So it was always full of surprises. Any final questions, thoughts, reflections? So I'll finish there for today.